So today I was going to talk about patience. Patience is the next parami, the next perfection to be covered. And just mentioning that Rick Fields passed away, one of the great patience stories that I was told had to do with Julie Wester, who's one of the Spirit Rock teachers. She, before she was a teacher, or before she was a parent, I think, she was a hospice nurse. And she would go into people's homes and set up kind of hospice care in their homes and set up their, you know, the bedrooms to whatever needed for hospice. And as she was setting up the scene so the person could be at home for their dying days, she would at some point tell everyone involved, she would tell them, "There are no more emergencies." And you know, the person's dying. So that because her feeling was a sense of patience or acceptance or presence was more important. So something was more important than running around, "Oh my God, you know, it's an emergency." And when a person's finally decided, or when it's finally clear that this is what the route's going to take, maybe there are no more emergencies. So you can reflect on that as I talk about patience. When I reflected on patience this last week, I was kind of delighted by the reflections. I kind of liked the more I thought about it, the more kind of tickled and delighted I was by the idea of patience. And I've enjoyed it for a long time. But I'm also aware that patience is maybe misused by a lot of people, both for themselves and also sometimes by the people around us who tell us we need to be patient. Sometimes patience is understood to be you know, just shut up and you don't count, you know, your issues aren't important, and just be patient means, you know, just cool it, Buster. And sometimes this notion, that notion of patience can kind of imply that your voice or what you have to say is not important, and you shouldn't cause any waves or cause any disturbances. Kind of subtle form of maybe oppression even that can come even, you know, within a family when we're told to be patient. So there are problems with the word patience, but there also there's a lot of beauty to the word, to the state, to the place, and it's one of the 10 perfections, one of the 10 inner qualities that needs to be brought to perfection in order for a person to become a full-fledged Buddha by the tradition. So in the mythology of the tradition, one of the things that the Buddha did in his former lifetimes before he became a Buddha, he spent many, many lifetimes perfecting his patience. And all kinds of wonderfully terrible things would happen to him. And he would try to be patient in the midst of it. And what does it mean to be patient in the midst of terrible things? There are three aspects to this Buddhist notion of patience. One is maybe gentle perseverance, just maintaining our efforts and keep going, not giving up. The second is patience under insult. And that's a good one, since life is always inherently insulting to our ego. Another interpretation of the First Noble Truth, there is suffering, is there is insult to our ego constantly. And then if you're sensitive, if you're not sensitive, then you don't think so. So then the third is acceptance of truth. So kind of gentle perseverance, patience under insult, and acceptance of truth. And so the first one, perseverance, is very important for people involved in Dharma practice, because you need to have some patience in order to continue practicing. One of the traps for a lot of people who practice is to assume or think that that the course of progress, so-called progress, if you're willing to look at that point of view, that the practice develops in a linear way, that you go from a state of being unhappy to happy directly. You know, it's just getting better and better, more and more happy as you go here. And if somehow you get less happy as you go along, you get happy for a while, and then you get less happy, it means you failed. It means something terrible about you. Or you go from less concentrated to more concentrated, or whatever kind of this idea of your idea of how to measure your practice, that people often have some idea of it's linear and get disappointed or discouraged when somehow the linear progress doesn't continue. I think of maybe more useful, that's kind of a one-dimensional view of practice. It's just like this line, right? A more useful one maybe would be that it starts off being practice is like a crumpled piece of paper, completely crumpled. And slowly it's going to unfold and straighten out and get all straight and even. And you don't know which corner is going to unfold next. You know, it just kind of does it in its own way. And then finally it opens up all the way. So you don't know which corner of your life is going to open up next. So it could be that you're sitting in a lot of calm and joy for some weeks or months in your practice, and suddenly you find yourself really agitated. And you say, uh-oh, I'm backsliding, you know, I used to be a good practitioner, I had a lot of concentration and joy, and now I'm just a failed practitioner. And that doesn't acknowledge that that practice doesn't unfold linearly. Sometimes after the very fact that we've had a period of calm and subtleness and ease with ourselves in our practice gives a kind of gives rise to kind of inner sense, inner strength, or inner openness for some buried material, something we've never really looked at, to finally come up to the surface. And lo and behold, it's agitating what comes up, and it needs to come up. It needs to come up sooner or later. And the period of stability in practice allows for that to finally surface. So to have some idea of linear progress is a setup for more insult, for more suffering. It's a lot easier to be patient about your practice if you think of it in a non-linear way. It's more like maybe a paper that's unfolding slowly in all kinds of ways. It's fine. It's actually wonderful to have aspirations in practice. But aspiration and expectation are two very different animals. And expectation leads to impatience. And impatience is a form of suffering. To feel the joy of simply engagement, doing the best we can, the joy of knowing what our intention is, and doing our best to live our intention or practice our intention. Let the results be what they are. We're not so concerned about the results as we are giving expression to our best intention. So I know my practice life, if you look at it from a linear point of view, it's just a mess sometimes. It goes all kinds of spirals. But my intention to practice is relatively unwavering compared to the state of my mind, my concentration or whatever happens to me. And I take refuge in my intention, and that gives me a lot of patience. Patience, perseverance. we're able to kind of persevere or continue practicing or continue with patience in our life. Often when we have new meaning or different a sense of priorities or understanding of what our values are, what can be done. So for example, when I was first introduced to Vipassana in Thailand, I was practicing intensely on retreat for 9-10 weeks. And then I was invited by my teacher to go into Bangkok, and he was going to preside over the funeral of some wealthy Thai general who had died. And it was going to be this huge, gaudy funeral ceremony. So I don't know why he wanted me to be there, but I came along. And I was sitting there, and I couldn't understand anything because it's in Thai, and it seemed kind of, it wasn't the kind of place that grabbed my interest. And I started getting bored. When am I going to get out of here? And then I remembered, I've been practicing mindfulness for 9-10 weeks now. Why don't I just practice? And so I just started practicing in the moment, and just practicing what was going on, being mindful of sounds, listening to the sounds, Thai language, looking at all the plastic flowers, just kind of being present in a mindful way. And my boredom vanished, my sense of oppression vanished, and I could just practice in the middle of it. And what I learned from that is that I always have access to the practice as something I can do in any difficult situation. And that's valuable for me. And to the degree in which practice has value for me, I have access to something that can always, in some sense, put a different meaning on what's happening in this given moment. I can always find a healthy meaning in what's happening. I don't have to discard it or get impatient or bored or whatever what's going on. I can always practice in the middle of what's going on right now. So to maintain a steadiness of practice, practice life, to sit every day in a steady way, be patient with sitting every day, to whatever way you're practicing, to do it in a steady way and be patient with it, to maintain the continuity. Continuity of practice is one of the keys to letting a life of Buddhist practice kind of sink into our bones and our marrow. The second form of patience is that of patience under insult. And there's many kinds of insults. And there's many wonderful examples of people who've been patient under insults. And a lot of these examples come from people reevaluating the difficulty, the insult, the challenge, from a different kind of level of meaning, a different meaning than what we normally assign to it. So, for example, the civil rights movement and the nonviolent actions they did and Martin Luther King, they were willing to endure all kinds of insult, physical insult to themselves, because they understood it in a larger context of meaning than their own individual ego, their own individual difficulties or pain. And because of the larger sense of meaning, they saw that it had purpose to be patient while someone was beating them over the head with a baseball bat or whatever it was. And in fact, if we look back at those stories, we see there was really meaning in that, and it was transformative to many people, to the whole country, in a sense, that there were people who were willing to be patient, to endure insult from a different perspective. I probably told this story before, but I apologize if you've heard it, of this woman I met who had gone down to the South and was doing some kind of nonviolent disobedience and on some street corner, and every day these white racists would come along and yell and scream, and then they'd come over and they'd beat her up, and then it would somehow the beating would be broken up, the fighting would be broken up, and people would go their way. But every day, when it happened, she would just sit there and allow these people to kind of beat her up until someone else broke it up. And this continued for 3 days, and the third day, the same person came back the third day to beat her up. So, you get out of here, you don't belong in the South, leave our problems to ourselves. And the person was about to beat her, maybe even started beating her, and she didn't do anything again. And the guy just stopped in his tracks, and he looked her in the eye, he looked each other in the eyes, and he just couldn't do it anymore. And he stopped and said, "What's going on here? You know, you got to tell me what's happening here." And somehow then they were able to have a conversation, and the whole thing was changed. And what she reported was the person was changed. The person who was beating her was changed deeply inside in a way that he couldn't have been changed if she had responded in kind. Probably would have gotten more angry and entrenched in his ways. So Gandhi, for example, also was one person who had had assigned different meaning to what was happening, and because of that could be profoundly patient with the situation. The example of wonderful example, another story that's commonly told, of Tibetans who are imprisoned by the Chinese, and there's one man in particular. This is the most common story. He was a monk in India, and was known. He lived in a cave and was known for his being very advanced in his meditation, and. So some researchers from Harvard Medical School went to the Dalai Lama and asked if they wanted to do some kind of, electrode research on a good meditator. And he said, "Well, go find this guy." He sent a letter to this guy in the cave and said, "Please go to Harvard. Leave your cave." And so certain that he went to Harvard, and they plugged them all up and did whatever they did. But, even research subjects, get the weekend. So what do you do with a meditating monk on weekends? So they said, "Well, let's take him to the Insight Meditation Center, the meditation center which we have in Barre, Massachusetts, to show him what it's like." So they brought him there, and And it was explained to him that, and he told a little bit about his life, and explained to the people there that he had a very deep meditative attainments. And he told about his life and how he had actually been a resistance fighter to the Chinese, and at some point had been captured, and he had been many years in jail and had been tortured and by the Chinese many times, and eventually I guess was released or escaped and escaped to India, where he became a monk and went into practice. And it's somewhat unusual for Tibetans to become ordained as monks late in life. Usually they do it when they're still quite young. They can often do it, their schooling is even in monastic settings. So for someone as an adult or well into their adulthood to become a monk, you don't expect a lot of them to make a lot of progress. It's kind of in that scene. But he had made a lot of progress with meditation. It was respected a lot. So I think it was Sharon Salzberg asked him what he attributed his amazing progress in his meditation. And he answered, because when the Chinese were torturing me, all I tried to do was have compassion for them. Isn't that an amazing story? So he had something about his values, something about his understanding of life, understanding of who he was. It was more important to be engaged in practice of compassion for his torturers than it was to get angry or upset or afraid or all the other options that many of us could imagine we would be doing if we were in that situation. And he felt that there was a lot of meaning for that for him, and he actually attributed his ability to get deeply settled and concentrated in practice on having done that practice. So there's lots of examples of developing patience by understanding the situation in a wider point of view. It's not just simply a personal situation, but there's other people who can be benefited or transformed, other situations. Maybe the situation can be transformed much better if we're patient under the situation and find some way out of compassion and loving kindness to address it, rather than to rush into our normal reactions of anger and upset. There's another very different form of patience, which is, doesn't involve reassessing the meaning of it, doesn't involve enduring the situation, and real patience doesn't require effort. It is a doing of sorts. It can be seen as a doing, but it's not. You know, we think of effort and patience as, well, let's count to 10, you know, and then we can, you know, be patient through that and not, you know, yell or explode. For some people, patience is something really tense and something that requires a lot of effort and energy. And I like to point out the difference between two people who are both, you say both of them are patient in the same trying situation, and one of them, it's very difficult in a trying situation, and one of them, all his or her buttons are being pushed, and my person counts to 10 and breathes really deeply and closes their eyes and is mindful and, you know, and thinks about all kinds of wonderful things about Tahiti and just to get out, you know, to try not to react, and it's a lot of effort in order to kind of not explode in the situation. But you see that person, and you say, well, that person, you know, staying cool. You know, that person's not as patient because the person hasn't exploded yet. The second person also looks very patient in the same trying situation. But in the second person, there's no buttons to be pushed. And so the person doesn't have to count to 10, doesn't have to make all this effort, because nothing inside of them is being evoked. Part of the function of mindfulness practice is for us to really clearly see our buttons, see what happens in us, what gets pushed. And if we can understand what gets pushed, it's a lot easier to develop a patience which is effortless rather than a patience which is a lot of effort. So part of patience doesn't even involve a reevaluation of the situation, but involves a reevaluation or new relationship to our own buttons inside of us, what gets pushed. And maybe finding a way of not having anything at stake. We have much less at stake in life than most of us realize. And if we realize that, we can be much more patient. Some teachers I know talk about one way to find this effortless patience is to look in the spaces between your thoughts and hang out there. Because usually the function of impatience has a lot to do with our involvement with our thinking, which But if you find the space between your thoughts, you'll find a place where the insults are not going to be of much meaning or importance. And then the third form of patience is the patience of is acceptance of truth. The word shanti or kanti, the Sanskrit and Pali words, has a very profound meaning in Buddhist texts, where it doesn't mean patience in our normal sense of the word patience, but rather means acceptance of truth, understanding how the truth of the present moment and all levels of truth, but it's particularly the deepest aspects of reality, acceptance of that. And it requires a kind of patience, because to the degree to which we're hung up with our ego, our sense of self, deep spiritual insight is, unfortunately, my friends, is an insult to your ego. Not just reality, but real deep practice. It's very hard to maintain a self-centered view about the universe or oneself. One practices really deeply. And so it's quite common for people to actually get afraid when they see the fact that there's fundamentally no self that to hang on to or defend or to protect or to provide some kind of idea of security. And this vision of no self, the vision of emptiness, can be for some people very frightening. So the acceptance of truth in its deepest level means acceptance of this very deep truth, that patience of this very deep truth, that there is no self that to protect, or there is no self to provide a reference point or orientation in a fundamental way for who we are. To let go of all our clinging. Acceptance of truth. In that patience, maybe is effortless, can be effortless, and maybe it doesn't involve a doing. Maybe the opposite of impatience should not be considered patience. But some people like to point out the opposite of impatience is contentment, to be content. And so one way to cultivate patience is to cultivate contentment. And one way to cultivate contentment is not to chase after all the needs and whims of the ego. Find an alternative for how to live a life that's not egocentric, but rather is ego-porous. So the cultivation of patience is what the Buddha did for many, many lifetimes. And only when he developed great patience, willing to not to have his ego, his buttons, pushed by any difficulty and challenge of life, was the Buddha ready for his final enlightenment. And as we, each of us, practice mindfulness, I think some appreciation of patience, both as something that we use to support our mindfulness, and also something to kind of tickle us with, because ultimate patience is not a doing. So how do you relate to a practice which you can't do? I think it's kind of nice, it tickles my mind to think of it. So what are your thoughts about patience? What are your experiences with patience? What are your questions this morning, Carol?
I was thinking as you were talking and relating it to how I've dealt with problems, etc. And I just see that it's a process, that it's a process of, you know, I was way back at the beginning of reacting so strongly and with some issues, not all issues, but with some issues in my life, I can see where I just see it as a truth and much more accepting of it.
One way to become more patient is to accept our common humanity. And there are our difficulties for sure, but a lot of them are shared by all people. It's part of being a human being. It isn't, we're not the exception.
I think education sometimes in
So you said, to tell me those two things again, that you had, law?
Certain stubbornness, refusal to let something be that needed to be, and also a tendency to just long suffer through. And I think those are the issues.
No. I think that the essence of practice of patience should be mindfulness, or is mindfulness. And to be mindful is to really study what's actually happening for us, and to have some understanding of the nature of our suffering. What are the causes and the conditions for our particular suffering? Some things are to be long endured, but some things of the world. But some things are not to be long endured, but actually to be practice with and try to overcome or try to come to terms with. And in particular, if we understand the nature of how we create our suffering for ourselves, stubbornness is something we create, for example, and there's a kind of suffering there. And if you use mindfulness, just pay attention to our tension, to our suffering, to our contraction, you'll become aware of the movements of how we cause our own suffering. If we're being insulted by the world, but in addition, we have an egocentric view of ourselves, which is being insulted also. We're contributing to our suffering by having this egotistical sense of self, which is being threatened. Mindfulness practice then is to look at what are the buttons that we've created. Are they necessary? And respond them accordingly. So that's one key to your question. You know, to use more mindfulness to understand what you're doing in a situation, what your responsibility in a situation might be. But in terms of when there's problems, that external problems, and people are doing something that shouldn't happen, then we have to use. There's no, you know, magic teaching, spiritual teaching that says what you should do. We have to use our common sense and our wisdom to know when it's best maybe not to say something, or when it's best to actually say something. And the practice of patience is to maybe to learn to wait until we're no longer angry before we say something. That's what I try to do with my own life. If I get angry, if the situation allows for it, I'll just be with my anger and be with my thoughts and my concerns for how long as it takes until the anger has dissipated, and to see more deeply what's going on, to really understand it. And once the anger is dissipated, then if it's still appropriate, I'll go back to the person and talk to them. It isn't that we're supposed to, you know, pause and not kind of address the situation immediately because we should just ignore it or deny it or be aloof from it. But it's very valuable to not act on patience, on anger, to be patient with anger, to hang out with it until we've processed it some on our own, and then go talk and try to address the situation and as wisely as we can. When I started off the talk by talking about some of the problematic ideas of patience, the ways in which it's kind of oppressive for some people, one of the things I had in mind was, I don't know if this is fair or accurate enough, but it was in my mind, was I think a lot of women traditionally in American culture have been expected to be patient in situations they shouldn't have been patient in. But they shouldn't have been angry with necessarily, but they should have, you know, said something very strongly. So patience can be the idea of patience can be a very abusive if it's misunderstood, and this is what you're pointing out. I love it that I say this often, that when Indian Buddhism was transported to China, they had to translate all the Indian words from Buddhist words into Chinese words. And into Chinese characters. And the words for concentration and mindfulness, being kind of the partners in Buddhist spiritual meditation. The way they translated concentration and meditation and mindfulness is with the characters stop and look. Concentration is stopping and mindfulness is looking. And I think of that as being an element of patience, of somehow pausing, some kind of pause in the middle of our life, to notice what's going on rather than barreling ahead to react all the time. To have, even for a moment, the pause button on a reactivity is a form of patience. And a whole situations can change dramatically if we don't rush into our reaction, but take some moments to be mindful of what's actually happening here. And that's a form of patience that's very powerful. Mira.
I know for me, this morning I realized, yesterday was the day where patience has done me well. I found out I have low stomach acid, which is contributing to my problem, so I'm told, you know, I should put follow hydrochloric acid, so after I eat. And yesterday, when my symptoms were coming back, and, you know, oh my God, I put, you know, pop some more pills. And sure enough, I think I, you know, took too much. And I kind of killed me last night, this morning. But you know, it was, I think what was happening is I see the symptoms and I think, I better do something about it now, because this is going to last for 4 more years, but, you know, because I've heard people struggling with this for a long time. And I wasn't in a place where I could just say, okay, it's, you know, it's like the whole non-linearness of illness. I wasn't in a place where I could see that and stay with it, but I ended up overcompensating and causing myself more suffering.
That's a very good observation. There was a woman, is a woman at this retreat, who's been practicing for a number of years, but she came at some point during the retreat and told me that she's never sat still through a whole sitting. She actually fidgets a lot and moves a lot, she said. And so I said, well, at some point I told her, I didn't necessarily tell her she had to do it on that retreat. I said, at some point, you should take it on to absolutely, positively not move during a sitting, even if you're going to die. You know, even if, you know, even if, you know, you're not, you don't have to get concentrated, you don't have to get calm, nothing has to happen, you can get really agitated for all I care, but you can't move your body. You have to go through one sitting where you don't move your body one bit. And see what that's like, if you've never done that. So she came back the next day and said, well, after that we talked, I did it. And she said it gave her a lot of confidence to do that, to not react, because we tend to react so quickly, and we don't realize that we have resources inside of us to be patient, and maybe and pause and wait and with the situation. And part of the value of learning to sit with our aches and pains and our mind and our feelings in meditation, and not reacting and acting on it immediately, is we learn this ability to be a little bit patient and have these pauses so we can look more deeply.
I'm afraid I'm a little confused, because in the absence of buttons, it seems like we boil down to mere placidity.
Oh, I don't think so.
If one watches, say, the Reptile House, you can see a wonderful crocodile sitting with their mouth open just waiting for food to pass by. They're not patient.
Well, I think the word the buttons is, you know, such a vague word, we are responsive to the world. The world, we respond to what happens to us in the world, but our ability to be responsive is not the same thing as kind of the narrow idea of a button. A button is when our ego has something at stake, and we have this little hook of ego, you know. This means, you know, this threatens my sense of self, or this supports it. So, for example, to get praise and blame, that is, for many people, there's a button where praise and blame relate, you know, touches, you know. And so you get praise, wow, you know, you get more energy, and it's really great. And you get blame, and, you know, oh my God. And it's possible to go through life and not have a button that's affected by praise or blame. You know, someone praises you, and you can appreciate it. Yesterday I spent a little bit of time with James Beres, one of the teachers, and he was talking about how people often come to him and thank him for his teachings or for whatever he does, and he feels that when he teaches, he's not the one who's teaching, he's not responsible exactly, but he doesn't want to kind of put a damper on their appreciation, so he kind of thanks them and receives it, and as soon as he receives appreciation, he says, he sends it up. Wow. He just kind of lets it go and lets it kind of radiate everywhere. He doesn't have a button for it. He doesn't take it on as his own. So I was kind of referring to the buttons in a narrow sense. There's an interesting distinction to be made between those emotions that are elicited or born out of our sense of separation from the world, or those emotions which cause more separation in the world, those emotions that are born out of having some sense of self to begin with, and those emotions that are born out of a sense of connectedness and create connectedness, those emotions which are born out of response to the world that have nothing to do with our ego. And so, for example, compassion there's no buttons being pushed in the narrow sense of buttons, but certainly part of us is responding. So maybe we have to come up with a better... Sometimes rather than buttons, people use the word hooks. There's no hooks. So I don't know what the opposite... those things that stimulate compassion, you know, is it a button? Is it a... Yes?
I was, after we've been talking about patients for about 15 minutes, I was aware that I'm not sure if I have a clear definition in my mind of what patience is, and I wonder if you could define patience, what you think of when you think of patience, how you would define the word patience.
Well, I think I almost prefer not to have a single definition for it. But rather, I like that these three different definitions I gave of, one of them is perseverance, is keeping up, continuing with our best efforts, continuing with our efforts, even when things get difficult and challenging and don't necessarily go according to our liking. But to continue, especially with spiritual practice, to continue with our practice, just keep it kind of steady, continuous involvement with it, through the ups and downs of life. That perseverance is a form of patience. Patience under insult means not to succumb to our anger or our aggression or our despair when we are insulted in some way, when life threatens us in some way, but rather to use our ability to be mindful, to be present, and really to pause and be with our reactions, to be with our emotional responses, and then to see if there's a wiser way to respond rather than responding habitually. So using mindfulness to pause and to be deeply mindful, not to be be patient, and to be patient under insult. That's one meaning of it. Another meaning of it, of patience under insult, is not a doing at all, not even being mindful. It almost doesn't exist. Maybe it doesn't exist. It's a kind of patience when you're, like I said, where you don't have any buttons to be pushed. Or maybe you have buttons to be pushed, but you realize that in your depth of who you really are, there are no really any buttons. In the depth of who you are, there's nothing at stake. And so you just settle back to that place. And so that those more superficial buttons you have don't get much juice or attention. That's another kind of patience. And then the last one is acceptance of truth. To be willing to accept, to be willing to be open and present for whatever is really true in a situation. Many of us are experts at avoidance and denial and rationalization and explanation and all that, and not really be present for things as they really are. So the third form of patience is a willingness to see and be present. It's kind of a seeing, a willingness to see deeply without any resistance how things really are at this moment. Is that helpful for...
More like aspects, those are all aspects of patience. The word patience.
Yeah.
When we've been talking, I kind of thought back to the story about Jan Watson.
Julie.
And when we're confronted with our death, there's this sense of letting go, this lack of control. And I think of patience, the reverse of it is trying to control, like trying to get someplace on time. We're trying to do things. It's all obviously ego-centered, not self-centered. And this sense of the sense of letting go of these controls either being removed from us as we pass from this life, letting go of these things.
and just notice, for me, I like to notice what am I trying to control here in this situation? And am I attached to this and the suffering that it causes? You know, and then it's like, oh, I'm late or whatever, you know. And in our culture here, there's this ample opportunity, you know, to look at that element. And I think that's like another aspect of practicing patience in a sense, giving up that control and watching.
It's great to be in a country like India where you don't expect things to work. Often, and you become much more patient. You know, train's not on time. Okay, well, and here we expect things to work, and so then we get upset.
When I just came back from India a year and a half ago, I came back here, and I was like, things are just way too orderly here. I mean, everything's just too perfect. You know? So it's interesting.
Yes.
That story that you told about Jamie Burrath and that just taking in the appreciation but then turning it over has nothing to do with me. I was just thinking, well, what would that be like to do that when triggered with things that aren't appreciation and just taking it in, thank you, and then turning it over and saying, this has nothing to do with me.
Did I tell you the story last week of when the Buddha was insulted? Wasn't here? I don't know. I've given like 15 Dharma talks in the last 12 days, so literally. So I haven't told you that story. I'll tell you this very quickly. This man came to the Buddha and insulted him. And the Buddha said, do you ever have... guests, friends who come visit you at your house? And the guy said, what? You're changing the subject. And he said, well, yes. And does it ever occur that those friends bring with them a gift to give you? And he says, yes. What would happen if they came to offer you the gift and you refused to accept it? Well, then it would remain theirs. So, meaning that, you know, the Buddha was not going to accept the insult, so it remained with him. So, yeah, so what is it like, you know, if we feel insulted by someone, to just let it go? Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I really enjoyed your talk about patience. I've always thought of myself as a very patient person, but I think I was really confusing that with passivity, because what I noticed is the more I'd be patient with somebody, the more resentment would be building up inside till I get to the point where I just can't be here anymore because I'm just too resentful of listening to somebody talking on and on and on or whatever.
That's profound. That's really great what you thought about now, what you realized. There's a huge difference. And we're not supposed to be passive, we're not supposed to be to have any kind of resentment build up is not being patient, and that's where I think there's a lot of interesting places now for you to be mindful with this understanding. Thank you. I need to go soon because I am supposed to be back up at the retreat and close up the shop. So. Thank you all very much for the lovely morning, and I'll see you next week. Next week I'll come on time.